Welcome back to another Friday on the Damage Report. I'm Ravonna filling in for John Iadarola. And because it is Friday, I am joined today by Brett Ehrlich, the incomparable Brett Ehrlich, but apparently not the only Brett Ehrlich if you Google that name anymore.
That's true. Yes, I did reveal in the pre-show that I do Google my name every so often. And this idiot basketball operative, either at Nike or the NBA, is stealing my thunder. And he probably gets a lot more free crap than I do. And I don't like it. And he must be stopped. Not really, but there's a part of me that does want to stop him. How are you doing, Ray?
I'm good. I'm lucky as someone who got to choose the name that I present on the internet. If you Google it, nothing else comes up except for like one Romanian pop star whose name is vaguely close to mine. But I'm the only Ravonna as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, it's so funny. Is it still a thing where it like auto-corrects what everyone else is searching about you? That was always my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. So for a while, the number one was Ravonna disability, which was crazy to me. Just trying to figure it out.
there's always, for me, it was Brett Ehrlich height, Brett Ehrlich gay, Brett Ehrlich. And then I did enough horrible, disgusting, weird, non like alluring sexually topless shots of myself and everything I did because I weighed like 112 pounds. It was all ribs. And so I was so happy when Brett Ehrlich shirtless became the number one search for me. And I'm very happy about that.
Nice.
Yeah, there you go.
Also say when you started to say basketball earlier, I thought you were going to say a totally different word. And I was like, whoa, we can say that? It's totally changed how I'm going to do the show. Okay. But let's just start with the news that everyone's talking about, including Brett on Twitter. Tweeted a very not classy joke about it. So everyone, if you're a big Dianne Feinstein head, there's someone to get mad at. But of course, breaking news, California Senator Feinstein has passed away at the age of 90. So young, who could have possibly seen this coming? But apparently she died yesterday evening and her staff was informed at 9 a.m. today. Let's talk a little bit about her legacy. ABC News 7 reported that in Congress, Feinstein served as the first woman to chair the Senate Rules Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. She authored the 1994 federal assault weapons ban, leading to a 10-year restriction on certain semi-automatic weapons. In 2014, Feinstein released a report revealing how the CIA was detaining and interrogating potential terrorists, sometimes torturing the suspects. The release of the report led to anti-torture legislation. It continues on that Feinstein's legislative accomplishments include creating federal coordination of Amber Alerts, the National Child Abduction Warning System, passing the California Desert Protection Act, which protected millions of acres of California desert and created the Death Valley and Joshua Tree National Parks, reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act to protect women from domestic violence and sexual assault, and authoring the 2022 Respect for Marriage Act to enshrine marriage equality into federal law. Of course, though, on the flip side of her accomplishments, is everything else that she's done, including choosing to run for re-election at age 85 and leaving the Democrats high and dry on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and just speaking to her health a little bit. In recent years, Ms. Feinstein, 90, had suffered from frail health and memory issues that made it difficult for her to function alone and prompted calls for her to step down, which she consistently rejected. Her condition had grown more acute over the past several months after a bout with shingles that caused serious complications, including a case of encephalitis, and prompted her to begin using a wheelchair in the halls of the Capitol. So now, obviously, the question is Governor Newsom going to appoint Barbara Lee, which he has indicated in the past is not in the cards, or another Black woman to fill Feinstein's seat? So, I mean, hopefully that is what happens. Hopefully it's Barbara Lee, but Gavin Newsom has been pivoting hard to the right in the past few weeks. So, I mean, it's really just wait and see. Some other things that I remember of Dianne Feinstein today is the time that she congratulated Tim Scott for his hard-fought and won Senate campaign in Georgia. thinking that he was Raphael Warnock. That happened. The time when she was the mayor of San Francisco, when she released the only concrete evidence that investigators had on the Night Stalker, which was the shoes he wore, causing him to throw them over the Golden Gate Bridge and made the investigation tougher. When she was a prosecutor, she prosecuted women for getting abortions. And of course, who can forget the infamous time she was addressing young climate activists and essentially told them to F off because she knows what she's doing. And obviously, she knew she wasn't going to be around to suffer the devastating effects of climate change. So, you know, what dog did she have in that fight other than protecting her financial portfolio? I mean, I don't know, Brett. I'm one of those people who feels like I don't necessarily have that impulse that we can't criticize someone in death the exact same way I would have been criticizing them in life. The one thing that's really bugging me is that she leaves an empty seat in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And essentially now Joe Biden is not going to be able to do one of the most important parts of his job, which is appoint federal judges to the bench. And that, I mean, she ran a re-election at age 85. Who could have seen this coming? Literally, absolutely everyone. It was a selfish act. I don't know. I don't have a very high opinion of her. Of course, trailblazer for women, but in office, there was some bad decision-making.
Right. There's a lot to unpack there. For me, looking at what you said about Dianne Feinstein running for re-election at 85, the other fact remains that she got elected. And yeah. Maybe it's because I went to a Catholic school and you're supposed to say thank you for all the horrible things that happened. But I am grateful for that fact because it just reminds me in these times when I'm like, everybody has heard all this stuff. Everybody cares as much as I do. It reminds me that most people don't. And in a world where you have a lot of facts saying that this person should probably not be seeking office again for her own good, for our own good, for the nation's own good, for the voters' own interests, if you sat them down and took them through the timeline, people are like, I don't know. I know that name. And they vote for it. And that's kind of what's in place. And there's a lot of cool stuff about it. Like I would love to have the kind of job where I just like get to do it until I die. And it's not that hard. And it's like if I want to do it, I get to do it. There were some questions about whether she actually had the mental capacity to decide whether she wanted to do it. Some of my favorite moments toward the end there were when she only had to say the word I. She had no clue in one of the proceedings that that was what she was supposed to do. So she just went into what she'd been doing over and over again nonstop for decades and decades, just kind of by rote repetition. She just kind of locked in there. But I don't know. It's also the other thing I'll say is before we get into like the specifics of who might replace her, is that with. I guess we'll do that right now. Like the people who might replace her, Gavin Newsom has said, you're right, in the past he's going to appoint a black woman. The highest ranking black woman is Barbara Lee. But he also said pretty specifically, I will not get involved in this primary. So he said he wasn't going to appoint anyone running. So there's a handful of people that are in like the state attorney general and some LA council people that were cited by Adam Nagurny in the New York Times today that are front runners. He can do it fast. He should do it fast. He does that stuff fast. It should happen. When there was a vacancy yesterday, when there was a vacancy in the wake of the 2020 election, he chose Kamala Harris's successor, Padilla, and he got reelected by everybody to fill a new term. So he's kind of a huge kingmaker, and it's just another thing about Gavin Newsom that puts him at the center of attention, having a lot more power than you would expect just like some rando governor to have.
Right. I mean, he's definitely, I think, relish that power for a little bit. I sort of don't buy into I don't want to get involved in the primary. You can't leave this seat open. I mean, we're too far out from the election. You have to appoint somebody and that person might go on to win become the elected senator in that position. But I mean, you have to make a decision because the balance of the Senate is so like teetering on a knife's edge that it's an important function of your job. And I mean, just appointing some schmuck who's not even running, I don't think is necessarily helpful to the Democratic Party. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I get it. But he will have someone like Gavin Newsom has a bunch of categories of lists, right? He's got binders full of lists. One of them is going to be people that will do him a solid in the meantime and then disappear from this discussion. Yeah. And so he will not, it's the same way that people like Trump won't choose Ron DeSantis as his vice president because he doesn't want someone who's in the discussion of possibly being president someday. He picks a Mike Pence, he picks someone like ridiculous that is known to be weaker than him. The same is true for whoever Gavin Newsom's gonna select to replace Feinstein. He's gonna find someone who's just like, oh, I've got like 10, you know, there's people like LA City Council people on the list. A civil rights lawyer in Oakland named Angela Glover Blackwell, Holly Mitchell's an LA County City Supervisor, These are people that have a long way to go and this will raise their name recognition to get them like the next step on the ladder. But that next step is definitely not senator for those people.
We're 62 hours away from shutting down the government of the United States of America, and Republicans are launching an impeachment drive based on a long debunked and discredited lie. No foreign enemy has ever been able to shut down the government of the United States, but now MAGA Republicans are about to do just that. But they don't want to cut off public services to the people and deny paychecks to more than a million service members without first launching an impeachment drive, even when they don't have a shred of evidence against President Biden for an impeachable offense.
That was part of ranking member Jamie Raskin's opening statement in the first hearing for the Biden impeachment inquiry. Now, a large part of the Democrats on the committee's testimony surrounded the lack of legitimacy for the hearings because there was no evidence. There's been no formal vote. It's not under oath. There's no fact witnesses. I mean, the list goes on and on. And the fact that this is their focus instead of the impending shutdown. Now, according to House Republicans, the inquiry is going to focus on answering the following. The focus is first, did Joe Biden as vice president and or president take any official action or affect any change in government policy because of money or other things of value provided to his family or him from foreign interests? Second, did Joe Biden as vice president and or president abuse his office of public trust by providing foreign interests with access to him and his office in exchange for payments to his family or him? Third, did Joe Biden as vice president and or president abuse his office of public trust by knowingly participating in a scheme to enrich himself or his family by giving foreign interests the impression that they would receive access to him and his office in exchange for payments to his family or him? Fourth, did Joe Biden abuse his power as president to impede, obstruct, or otherwise hinder investigations, including congressional investigations or the prosecution of Hunter Biden, despite there being no evidence to suggest that any of those things are the case? But to help answer these questions, they brought three expert witnesses. Here's AOC asking them why they're there, and you're going to love their answers.
In your testimony today, are you presenting any firsthand witness account of crimes committed by the President of the United States?
No, I'm not.
No, you are not. Ms. O'Connor, you are the second Republican witness here today. Have you, in your testimony, presented any firsthand witness account of crimes committed by the President of the United States?
I have not.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Dubinsky, as the third and final Republican witness in this hearing, have you, in your testimony, presented any firsthand witness account of crimes committed by the President of the United States?
I have not.
That's so awesome. It's so awesome that this is what our elected representatives are doing instead of, I don't know, preventing our government from shutting down and thousands of Americans being out of work for an extended period of time and not getting paid and people not being able to receive essential services. That's really cool. And one of the reasons why these are their witnesses, and I mentioned they have no fact witnesses, is because the people that they've already been presenting as the key fact witnesses were deposed. And none of them testified to seeing any impropriety on behalf of Joe Biden. In fact, every single one of them testified that Joe Biden did nothing wrong and had no involvement in Hunter Biden's business ventures with foreign governments and corporations and foreign governments. It's just so funny. It's so funny. But sometimes you don't even need the representatives to do the questioning. Here's the witness themselves ruining the GOP's day.
And I want to emphasize what it is that we're here today for. This is a question of an impeachment inquiry. It is not a vote on articles of impeachment. In fact, I do not believe that the current evidence would support articles of impeachment.
I am not here today to even suggest that there was corruption, fraud, or any wrongdoing. In my opinion, more information needs to be gathered and assessed before I would make such an assessment.
And you could probably assume that Republicans are not exactly loving this from CNN. You want witnesses that make your case. Picking witnesses that refute House Republicans' arguments for impeachment is mind-blowing, one senior GOP aide told CNN. This is an unmitigated disaster. But does the fact that it was a disaster matter to the Republicans? Of course not, because this is just meant to be a circus. So from that article, at the close of the impeachment inquiry hearing Thursday, House Oversight Chair James Comer announced that he was issuing subpoenas for the bank records of the president's son, Hunter Biden, and brother, James Biden. Brett, I just can't get over the fact that this is all happening while the government is, you know, teetering on the edge of shutting down. This is the focus, and it's so such a self-inflicted wound because they let Trump dictate the actions of the party by himself, by posts on social media, and then the result is that they have to put on this silly show.
Americans like saying the government's useless. A lot of Americans like saying the government's corrupt. A lot of Americans like saying, ugh, my tax dollars have to pay for this. That's like vaguely Republicanish language that they tap into a lot. However, Americans hate the government for doing exactly stuff like this. This is not the Republicans fixing the problems they say exist in the government. This is them acting them out in real time. They hate when the Republicans shut down the government. No one likes it. They get madder at the government in general when this kind of stuff happens. And it should be everyone should be reminded that the government might shut down, not necessarily because the Democrats and Republicans don't agree. It might get shut down because the Republicans and the Republicans don't agree. And rather than sit there and hash that out, what's happening? The main other thing they're doing is an impeachment inquiry during which is itself failing so horribly. And AOC is able, this person they call so stupid is, and an actress is able to get each one of the Republicans' own witnesses to say, I am not contributing anything to these proceedings. Meanwhile, the previous proceeding, I can sum up the evidence in the two Trump impeachments. The two, one, he said, I want you to do me a favor, though. He withheld foreign aid so that he could get a personal favor for his election hopes. And then on the second one was, I need you to find 18,000 votes. He asked the Secretary of State to mess up the election results on his behalf by just, quote, finding that many votes. Like, I can say that succinctly, and they're just like, I don't know, Biden, Hunter, laptop, he parties too hard, you know?
And that's a great point, and a point that was made, I think, really well by Representative Jasmine Crockett, because she was able to just rattle off just a few of the charges, a few of the indictments against Trump, the evidence against Trump, things that are actually backed by facts and rooted in evidence, as opposed to what the Republicans are doing here. So let's take a look at that.
When we start talking about things that look like evidence, they want to act like they blind. They don't know what this is. These are our national secrets. Looks like in the to me. This looks like more evidence of our national secrets, say on a stage at Mar-a-Lago. when we're talking about somebody that's committed high crimes, it's at least indictments. Let's say 32 counts related to unauthorized retention of national security secrets, 7 counts related to obstructing the investigation, 3 false statements, 1 count of conspiracy to defraud the United States, falsifying business records, conspiracy to defraud the United States. And I could go on because he's got 91 counts pending right now. But I will tell you what the president has been guilty of. He has unfortunately been guilty of loving his child unconditionally.
And she makes the point that I think I've been trying to articulate for quite some time, which is that so many of the Republican attacks on Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, it's just them pointing out a relationship, a loving relationship between father and son. And I don't think it plays well the way that the Republicans are intending it to. I think so many people have the experience of a family member who struggled with addiction. You know, a family member who, despite all of your best efforts, has struggled to get it together, but you don't stop loving them and you don't stop supporting them. I think that that's such a universal experience that attacking Joe Biden for being there for his son during times of struggle with addiction, during struggles with mental health issues, doesn't make him look bad. I think it only makes him look like a loving father. So there's that point. But also, as far as that video goes, we did have to cut it off a little bit because obviously Trump's indictments are so many that we couldn't, you know, have time for her to list all of them. But I want to hit on what her final point was. You know, just there's nothing that they can attack Joe Biden on. So it is just saying, gosh, he loves his son so much. Isn't that cringe? But she wasn't the only Democrat who made that point or even, you know, brought fire to this otherwise insanely boring, and I'll just be honest, insanely boring impeachment hearing. Here's Representative Dan Goldman trying to help the Republicans and introduce some evidence.
So why don't we have some of the fact witnesses here? You've brought them in. They've come in already. What about Devin Archer? Now, Mr. Donalds and the chairman now want to disavow Mr. Archer's testimony that Mr. Biggs entirely relies upon, but they don't want him to come sit here. Why? Well, maybe because he testified that Joe Biden never discussed business with Hunter or other business associates. He got nothing from their businesses, and he never took any official acts related to the businesses.
And Brett, I think my favorite thing about the Devin Archer arc of the Joe Biden impeachment investigation, whatever you want to call it, was that they put out in media and right-wing media that he was going to testify that Joe Biden had, you know, they were like, he's going to be our bombshell witness. He's going to testify to this. And then they got him under oath and he did not testify to that whatsoever.
They're so bad at that. I think that's amazing. I mean, and I wouldn't, they've proven that they suck because the whole the government shutdown that's looming is just McCarthy not being able to count votes. And that's like literally all you need to be able to do. They can't count on witnesses either. And the last thing I'll say on it is if they're going after Joe Biden for, quote, taking any official action or affecting any change in government policy because of money or other things of value provided to his family or him, like, look at Congress. That is how it works, by the way. Everybody gets money, whether it's campaign contributions, whether it's dark money contributions so that they can keep their lifestyle up. And then they just, you know, copy and paste legislative agendas from lobbyists all the time. Like, that's how it works in Washington. I'm not sure that's a slippery slope they want to tread on.
Especially considering that every time Jared Kushner has some real estate he needs to get rid of, you know, just, you know, who would have guessed, some random member of the Saudi royal family scoops that property up immediately. No wrongdoing there, though. We don't need to peer any further than the face of that issue. Okay, but we have to go to a break, but stick around because we'll be right back. And listen, I hate to bring it up, I feel like, with regularity, but Marjorie Taylor Greene's feet are not right. Have you seen them, Brett?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a paid subscriber to her Wiki feet. So yeah, I have seen them. They're fantastic. But that's just me. The more messed up, the better.
Right. The less toes, the better. God, just if you ever
she's such
seen
a graceful dancer. It's from being in ballet. Have you ever seen her on the like weird herky jerky?
Yeah.
Like, strange. What is it? Workout.
Dropping. Apparently, she dropped those weights on her toes a few too many times. Okay, enough of that. But let's talk about some other cringy Republican behavior that's going down. And because the girlies are fighting. And yesterday, House Republicans had a lot to accomplish. They had to begin impeaching Biden without cause, of course, and they had to do their jobs and fund the government, which they also didn't do. But you already know which one of those is a priority for them. We talked about that at length. But with just days until the government is shut down, the House Republican caucus met behind closed doors to try to come to an agreement. Did they? No. So what exactly, though, were they discussing at this meeting? Was it passing the Senate stopgap measure? No. Is it accepting the deal that had been brokered with Biden? No. It was how Kevin McCarthy can stand up straight without his spine? Maybe, because he gave in again to their demands. I mean, this guy, literally the flimsiest man I've ever seen in politics, which is saying something. But following the closed-door meeting, the House convened to vote on some spending measures. So from CNN, the House passed several spending bills late Thursday night, but the measures would not stop a shutdown and have no hope of passing in the Senate. The votes were part of an effort by House GOP leaders to try to show conservatives that they are working in good faith to advance full year funding bills. And they couldn't even do that because at the end of the night, however, a bill to fund the Department of Agriculture failed to pass on the floor with 27 Republicans voting against it, highlighting once again the difficulty the House GOP has had coalescing around spending bills. So what is their plan moving forward? Draft a spending plan that can't pass the Senate, would get vetoed if it did, but probably won't even pass the House. Surefire plan to save the government from shutdown and to get the American people on your side. So what is in it from the Hill? The plan, dubbed the Spending Reduction and Border Security Act, would extend funding through the end of October, but impose across the border cuts of about 30% with exemptions for national defense, the Departments of Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security, and for funding designated disaster relief. The House short-term measure also includes a chunk of the party's signature border bill known as HR 2, which would boost wall construction, hiring of border agents, and restrict access to asylum, among other measures. The bill also calls for the establishment of a fiscal commission that would identify solutions to achieve what it called a sustainable debt to GDP ratio and to balance the federal budget. It would recommend changes to improve solvency for some programs such as Medicare and Social Security. Now, we know what those changes are. They're going to cut benefits. They're going to raise the age of eligibility. And obviously, with the end goal of privatizing those exceptionally popular programs, time and time again shown to be the most popular government-run programs. And I just don't see the end goal in this, Brett. I can't fully understand on the policy side of things and on the political side of things, because it's not, I don't know, it's not like 2011 or something. It's not even earlier than that. People aren't, you know, dry heaving about the debt anymore. And the, you know, every the doomerism when they would say, oh, this date is going to come and then the whole world is going to fall apart because of the debt. It hasn't happened. And people just don't feel that strongly about it anymore. So this messaging to me, I can't wrap my head around it. I don't know.
I don't think, right, there is no strategy that you can wrap your head around because there isn't agreement on the strategy. There are people acting in their own self-interest within the party. And I don't even see, to your point, like a larger group of people who are like, oh, point for point, what Matt Gaetz is trying to get, I absolutely agree with. That's not a huge group of Americans relative to what you see the rest of the caucus doing. The rest of the Republicans are generally like, no, we're supposed to fight the Democrats, not ourselves. I don't see an upside in this. I other than Matt Gaetz personally getting more power within the party, But by and large, these kinds of movements from Republicans end up failing for the people involved in them, and maybe in the future benefiting the ones that survived a little bit. It'll overall change the Overton window, but it's very risky. And I think by and large, the American people just don't like it. Right. I understand wanting to cut programs is like a thing Republicans are for. There's too much spending on, social handouts. But I love that they call it the Spending Reduction and Border Security Act. Border Security is wildly expensive. Mm-hmm. So this might as well be called the Spending Reduction and Spending Increase Act. Or the like, there's certain people we don't care about act.
Especially when the things that you're talking about cutting are Social Security and Medicare. Again, two of the most popular programs that our government does. And you have an aging voter base who relies on those two things. So for your messaging to so much be around that, it's like, do you even know who you're trying to appeal to? And just to that point, and I think this might be the only thing that Matt Gaetz has ever said that was true, but he mentioned that there's 10,000 people in his district that are going to not get paychecks because of a shutdown, if a shutdown were to happen. So, and recent polling showed that most people blame the impending shutdown on Republicans. Generally, they hate Congress and politicians as a whole, but they blame Republicans more than they blame Democrats. And if you live in the district of a Republican elected official and you're not getting a paycheck, those people aren't going to like you more. They're not going to want to vote for you more if they're being asked to go into work because they work for the TSA or another role that is deemed essential and not get paid. They're being asked to work and forego a paycheck. That's not going to bring them more over to your side. I don't know. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an example of that sort of is in the aspirational way that the Republicans frame it. They know they can't say we're going to cut Medicare and Social Security. They lose it. Mike Lee loses it in the State of the Union address when it's like, what? That's a lie. And then you play a video of him saying like, we are going to dismantle Medicare and Social Security. That's why they name it. They phrase it. And this is, copy pasted on the Hill, in the Hill article you read from messaging from the Republicans, because many reporters are too stupid to see through it. It would recommend changes to improve solvency for some programs, such as Medicare and Social Security. They're not cutting it. They're making changes to improve solvency. And that's messaging that all Americans can get. Their eyes don't just glaze over like they're getting a visit from some kind of corporate consultant saying we need to eliminate redundancies, not fire people.
When I wake up, the first thing that crosses my mind is solvency. That is my primary concern every day when I have to go to the grocery store and, buy groceries and I have to fill up my car with gas. It's God, the solvency of government programs is what's weighing on my mind. But let's turn a little bit to, because I mentioned at the beginning of the story, the girlies are fighting. So let's talk about that. And the girlies in question are Matt Gaetz and Kevin McCarthy. So apparently McCarthy's been trying to signal in different ways that he's tired of Matt Gaetz's demands, and some not so subtle, because it started here with a prominent MAGA Twitter account, which is depressing to say that exists, posted this showing a Kevin McCarthy proxy had reached out to him to post paid anti-Gaetz and anti-shutdown content. So it says, howdy, got an advocacy campaign with budget. Do you do paid posts? If so, how do you work? By the way, the issue is against Gaetz and government shutdown. Let me know ASAP. And says, I'm a strong supporter of what Gaetz is doing. The more of the federal government we shut down, the happier we'll all be, which is, severely MAGA-brained individual, because it's just fundamentally not true. But so apparently, people working for Kevin McCarthy are doing these paid campaigns, reaching out to MAGA influencers, which is a career that you can have now. But Gaetz tagged McCarthy and called him pathetic. But apparently in a closed door meeting, they were yelling. They were screaming at each other. Their tensions were flared. So Gaetz gave his recounting of the altercation to The Hill. It reads, I asked McCarthy a direct question. Were you out there paying for people to try to create a false negative sentiment about me online? And his non sequitur retort was that he was giving out $2.5 million to other Republicans at breakfast. Then I asked him how much of that money he'd gotten from FTX's Sam Bankman-Fried. McCarthy, however, denied any involvement in the anti-Gates campaign, according to the lawmaker, and his outside legal counsel sent a cease and desist to the individual responsible for the solicitations earlier this week. Speaker told Gates that he is busy doing his job and trying to run the conference and essentially said, I'm not worried about you, Matt, according to a House Republican, although we know that's not true. I mean, he has shown time and time again that he's not only worried about Matt Gaetz, but willing to capitulate to him. But he did have the cease and desist letter sent. That is true. So here's that headline. McCarthy attorney sends cease and desist over anti-Gates campaign. The speaker denies he has anything to do with the social media effort against the shutdown, which also targets Representative Matt Gaetz. Of course, the cease and desist would be at representing themselves as having ties to Kevin McCarthy, because otherwise it's perfectly legal to just have that campaign as a private individual. But I don't really know who to believe in this. Of course, McCarthy does have some evidence, but there's no reason he couldn't have just sent the letter to cover his own ass. And if I was Kevin McCarthy, I definitely want to attack Gates somehow, and using MAGA influencers to do it seems like maybe the only line of attack he has, because he's constantly capitulating to him with policy in Congress.
Right. Like, I love Matt Gaetz's argument, which is, listen, the only way this could happen for people to come out against me is if they're getting paid by Kevin McCarthy, as if not everybody in the universe already looks at Matt Gaetz and is like, this guy sucks. Matt Gaetz is trying to hit him with like the, oh, how much money comes from Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. That is a statement that resonates with a lot of Americans. Let's get the money out of politics. And the reason that's a good fight for Gaetz to pick is the only reason that people become the leader of their party in this day and age is when they can raise a lot of money. McCarthy is in California, where people go to raise money. He's in Bakersfield, which is like severely methy, if you want to describe a part of California. It's the methy part. It's the part in GTA 5 where like Trevor lives. Like, that's Bakersfield. I love it very much. I have dear friends from there, but that's how I know about it. They're like, yeah, we got a lot of meth and a drive through Starbucks and whatever. Anyways, those are the two things. But yeah, so they need to look at all these behaviors, all these interactions between Kevin McCarthy and Matt Gaetz and say, like, this is a fight that I just don't think many Republicans are going to be happy about in the end, because it makes them look utterly terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's nice to be able to cover Republican infighting, because for so long the party was really in lockstep, and the leaders of the party had a good control over their caucus, which Kevin McCarthy obviously doesn't. But we'll keep you all updated on whether or not he ever finds his spine. But I believe we have to go to a break right now, so stick around. We'll be right back talking about updates on the abortion pill. Yesterday was International Safe Abortion Day, so you know what one Tennessee Republican did. Introduce a bill to ban medication abortion nationwide. I'm just to take 1 second to remind people that medication abortion is safer than Tylenol. It is significantly safer than drugs like Cialis that people are able to access easily. You can buy Tylenol over the counter. The medication abortion pill is safer than that. But with that, let's continue on to some facts about this bill from Jezebel. Representative Andy Ogles continued the rights war on abortion access on Thursday, joining the notoriously anti-abortion group Students for Life Action on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Ogles debuted legislation to ban medication abortion nationwide on the 23rd anniversary of the Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone, one of the two medications commonly used in medication abortion. And yes, we do have some of the footage of him introducing the bill.
It is nothing short of a tragedy that Biden and the careless FDA would put lives at risk for the sake of their genocidal political agenda. I'm honored to have partnered with Students for Life Action and Kristen Hawkins to introduce this important legislation, of course, our other partners. The Ending Chemical Abortions Act
would prohibit the use of dangerous drugs for the purpose of abortion. We're taking a stand against the irresponsibility of the Biden administration and working to protect women and girls across America.
Framing these as dangerous drugs is so absolutely disingenuous for the reasons I laid out earlier. But let's just talk about what the New York Times did, because they looked at more than 100 scientific studies spanning continents and across decades, and they've examined the effectiveness and safety of mifepristone and misoprostol. And a vast majority of the studies reported that more than 99% of patients who took the pills had no serious complications. Now, some did, of course, but these uncommon complications included hospitalization, blood transfusions, or major surgeries. Again, less than 1%. Now, we have a chart showing the safety of abortion pills in 86 of 101 studies. Almost no patients had serious complications. And we have this chart that shows that procedural abortion, 0.16% of patients had serious complication rates, 0.31% had serious complications from medication abortion. And then look at childbirth, 1.4%. People are at more risk of having serious complications from giving birth than they are from having an abortion, even a surgical abortion. So it is just, it just puts me beside myself to hear them call these things dangerous. Now, I mentioned that he was there with the group Students for Life, which has been instrumental in passing anti-abortion laws nationally. Jezebel reported that last year, Students for Life action helped pass 18 anti-abortion laws across the country and introduced 29 abortion bills at the federal and state levels, including similar medication abortion restrictions or bans. The group's biggest success has been supporting a state-level ban on distributing abortion pills in Wyoming. However, a judge temporarily blocked that law from taking effect, leaving abortion pills legal in the state. By the way, like all Republicans, he doesn't care about the child once it's born. In fact, Ogle said it's ridiculous to blame guns for the Covenant school shooting that left 3 children and 3 adults dead in Nashville in March of this year. Ridiculous. It is ridiculous to blame guns. Guns aren't dangerous. Medication abortion is dangerous. And Brett, they rely so much on lying. That is like a fundamental part of the anti-abortion crusade, is that they have to rely on lying to their audience.
Like, it is, when you dissect every bit of logic, it's basically just calling all of his intended audience stupid. Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous pill. Why? I guess your only argument left after it is that it ends the pregnancy. So it's dangerous for the fetus. That's right. Already your argument. He gets people out there and he's arguing like, oh, guys, we have to really take a big step to end this thing. No, all he's doing in that situation, he's not advocating for anybody's safety. He's not advocating for a betterment of the human condition in America. He's just trying to raise his own profile. It sucks. They all caught the car on this. It proves just how disingenuous they are, most of them, when they say like, oh, our legal argument is just to turn it over to the states. No, they just want to end a woman's right to choose, a mother's right to choose, a parent's right to choose what to do in those situations when you're having a baby. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it.
Right.
That's it. Of course. They want to end it. And it's, yeah. And this is like literally the safest, earliest, easiest way to do it.
Of course, they never highlight like the dangers of actually having to go through childbirth, or, you know, the potential complications that the child might suffer from childbirth. It literally is fundamentally just about taking away a woman's right to choose, like you said. Speaking of women, we've got a little time. Let's do this last story that I think is important to cover, because it would be a huge step forward in protecting victims of sexual assault. The Me Too movement encouraged women to speak up and name their abusers, but unfortunately for a lot of women, speaking out against their abusers means opening themselves up to defamation lawsuits. But California is taking steps to address that and protect victims. From Jezebel, California's AB 933, a newly passed bill that now sits at Governor Gavin Newsom's desk and could make it substantially more difficult for abusers to sue and exploit the legal system to harass their victims. AB 933, which amends California's civil code to treat communications made without malice regarding sexual assault, harassment, or discrimination as privileged speech. Now, you might be thinking, well, a defamation case is one of the only ways to clear your name if you were actually wrongly accused. But I'll remind you that one, the number of false accusations is exceptionally small because as we've seen time and time again, women are attacked for correctly naming someone as their abuser. The idea that someone would you know, go out of their way to lie, and what are they gaining from that? But also that this law would only prevent someone from suing if the allegations were made without malice. So in those fringe cases, they would still have the ability to pursue a defamation case. But on top of that, many people who choose to sue their victims, they're not doing it because they believe they're innocent or they've been wrongly accused. It's a tool that they use to intimidate their victims back into silence because lawsuits are costly. And defamation lawsuits are exceptionally revealing. Your abuser can, through the process of discovery, access your medical records, your financial records. They could even have access to your personal sexual history and use that to attack you. So much so that this is a problem that law professors, that lawyers talk about the pushback that these victims receive. So here's one person's story. At an April press conference marking AB 933's passage from the assembly, Victoria Burke, a professor at Southwestern Law School, recounted that after she was drugged and assaulted one night, a friend who is a defamation lawyer warned her not to speak publicly about the assault in a manner that might identify her assailant. I'm a law professor. I also know the law. I'm speaking the truth and also speaking my opinion as to how things went down that night, Burke said of her initial struggle to accept this advice. But if you look at Me Too and the aftermath, many people who spoke out have now been sued. And of course, a lot of the women in the Me Too movement were celebrities and the people they were accusing were celebrities. But it is not just famous celebrities who sue their accusers. And it's not just celebrities who get sued. In 2021, Know Your Nine published a study based on over 100 interviews with campus sexual assault survivors who had been attacked between 2002 and 2020 and found almost a quarter of them were threatened with a defamation suit from their attacker. Then this next one got to me. Nearly one in five said they were warned by their school of the possibility of defamation suits, and 10% faced retaliatory complaints filed by their assailant. Notably, a 2015 study interviewing 74 student survivors found 34% were forced to drop out of school. So not only were these women the victims of domestic violence, they were the victims of sexual assault. And then because of that, because they had the bravery to come forward and then were subsequently sued or faced retaliation, they had to drop out of school. That ended their educational career at that time. So I think it's really important, Brett, that California is taking steps to protect these victims, because I think the B2 movement did an awesome job at, you know, giving people confidence and, you know, embracing that people should come forward and name their accusers. But I don't think it effectively addressed what comes after that, right? If they choose to pursue a lawsuit against you. So these women need protection.
I mean, I think the law should be set up to accommodate for all of these situations. Like if, I don't like anything where it's like, well, the solution is not to go to court for it. The solution is we won't give you an avenue to achieve justice. But I also don't like people who are like, just by virtue of the fact that I got sued, I am now defamed. If you win that, like that's just how it plays out. And you're not, I mean, you should have be confident enough that, or find a way to use your exoneration to lead you to, you know, where usually at the end, if you win, the other person pays the legal bills. You can then, you know, get past that and move on with your life. Like you should message that into your lack of being, you know, your image rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see if Gavin Newsom signs it. There's been a lot of bills that were put before him that people expected him to sign, and then just for some reason, he chose not to. A few things that we've reported on here that we fully expected to become law in California that then went on not to be. So we'll keep you updated on that. But that is all the time we have. The aftermath is coming up after this for those of you watching on YouTube, on Twitch, and on our website. And if you're watching on linear, switch over so you can catch the aftermath.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.